This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Every U.S. president has tried to keep at least part of the press close by to build support for his policies. Abraham Lincoln literally kept the press close by until the day he died. Among the items in the president's pockets when he went to Ford's Theater on April 14, 1865, 9 newspaper clippings. And one of the first people to make it into his theater box after the shooting was a newspaper reporter. In life, Lincoln tried hard to shape public perceptions of his policies through the papers, while confronting difficult questions about the role of a free press in wartime. A new book by historian Harold Holzer explores this little-known facet of our 16th president. Holzer looks at the big technological changes driving the media industry, such as the telegraph and the development of wire services, such as the Associated Press. He also looks at the vigorous partisan press, in which newspapers aligned strictly with political parties and developed close relationships with politicians. Today on The Exchange, Lincoln and the power of the press. And let's hear from you. What would you like to know about press coverage of 150 years ago? What can this period teach us about the relationships between the media and politicians in our time? Call us The Exchange, number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also share thoughts and comments on Facebook or Twitter. Our guest for the hour is Harold Holzer, a historian on Lincoln and the political culture of the Civil War. He's written dozens of books on these topics and has a regular column, Ceasefire, in America's Civil War magazine. Holzer is also chair of the U.S. Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation and winner of the National Humanities Medal. His new book is called Lincoln and the Power of the Press. Harold Holzer, welcome to The Exchange.
No, thank you. It's good to be with you.
I think even those of us who are history buffs would be surprised to learn that at one point in his career, Abraham Lincoln actually owned a newspaper. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, let me begin with the fact that people of his day would not have been surprised. Politicians owned newspapers, and newspaper men became politicians with really dizzying regularity in the Lincoln era. But maybe Lincoln's would have seen as sort of surprising because the newspaper he ultimately chose to invest in was published in a language that he could never hope to read, and that is German. So that made it unique. So he decided a year before the presidential election of 1860, in which he was very interested at the time, not an outright candidate, but nobody in those days ever became a candidate for the nomination, he decided to help this struggling, really bankrupt German editor out of hock. He gave him $500 to get his printing press out of receivership and to start publishing a new German language newspaper in his hometown of Springfield, Illinois. And the deal that he struck, serving as his own lawyer — I know that lawyers are not supposed to do that, but he did because this was top secret — the deal was that Abraham Lincoln would expect this new newspaper to be completely loyal to the Republican Party and to the party platform. What did that mean? Well, Germans were flooding into the West, Illinois, Indiana. These states, some of which had been Democratic for many years, had an opportunity now to flip because German immigrants, German-American voters, were overwhelmingly Republican. But you had to get them to the polls. And the idea was that this newspaper could achieve that. That's what Lincoln wanted. And that's what it did for the next year and, 3 months. So much so that Lincoln signed the presses over back to the editor at the end of the 1860 election, gave him the printing presses, a real asset, never asked for the $500 back. And in the bargain, and this was common practice too, he made the editor American consul to Vienna, Austria. So there was a payoff at the end of the line, very common in American politics, not considered dishonest, and certainly, you know, par for the course even for Honest Abe.
But you mentioned, since a lot of this was top secret, the relationship between the press and politicians in some way was known, but in other ways people tried to still keep some kind of distinguishing characteristics between the two sides?
Well, I searched in vain for another example. Admittedly, did not delve as deeply into other politicians' involvements as Lincoln's, but I searched in vain for an example of another politician who thought that there was something that should not be disclosed about the relationship with the press and politicians and politics. And I think Lincoln's only problem here was that he was a little embarrassed that he was investing in a paper he couldn't read. Maybe he thought that would make him look silly. Because he was deeply part of the local Republican paper in Springfield, he was a big, almost a partner on policy in the Chicago Tribune, the Republican paper up in the Windy City. And, you know, he controlled editorial policy at those papers. Didn't have an ownership stake, but he wasn't interested in that.
Something that that Lincoln did, which politicians previous to him had done as well, was writing editorials sometimes under his own name and other times under an assumed name or no name at all. And what was the advantage that a politician like Lincoln would gain from being able to publish under a number of different personas?
Well, he was trying to make a name for himself as a young politician in New Salem, Illinois. He was the village postmaster, basically, when he started doing this. And I think part of it was to influence policy. He was a Whig early on and, you know, believed that the government should invest in infrastructure. We hear that again here in 2014. It's still a rallying cry for the Democratic Party. He thought the government should invest in infrastructure, and there were battles royal just on this subject that we consider sort of unsexy today. That was it. That was that, and tariffs were the big issue. So, you know, writing editorials under different names suggested that there was a lot of support for this policy. It also proved his writing ability and his energy to the editors, who then began promoting him for the state legislature and helped launch Lincoln's political career. So it's a very symbiotic relationship from the beginning. But listen, he was writing anonymous editorials up until the time he left Illinois for his inauguration as president. Right before he left, there was a lot of interest in the country, especially among moderates. There was a lot of support for the idea of Lincoln naming a Southerner to his cabinet in order to show that he was for conciliation, not secession and war. And Lincoln was concerned that if he nominated an outright pro-slavery Southerner, that there would come a moment when a policy difference would erupt between them and a question of who was going to be the lead person. So he wrote an anonymous editorial for the local Springfield paper saying, "We understand there is pressure on Mr. Lincoln to name a Southerner to his cabinet. The question is, when a policy difference erupts, is the president to defer to the cabinet member or the cabinet member to defer to the president?" It was printed in the Springfield paper, and it was, more importantly, reprinted all over the country. And the air went out of the balloon for that kind of solution.
In a way, it sounds a lot like the leaks that we read today from anonymous sources, the senior administration official who is perhaps floating an idea with trying to gauge public support without having to go on the record in their public role.
He did a lot of that. Once he became president, he leaked trial balloons both through others and really under his own name, starting this ingenious effort or campaign to convince the public about certain very difficult policy issues, principally involving race. One would not be surprised about that, through the mode of what we've come to call the public letter, but was really just letters to the editor, ordinary letters to the editor. The most famous of them came after Horace Greeley, the editor of the New York Tribune, wrote a really tough editorial condemning the Lincoln administration for not moving more quickly on emancipation. The inside joke was, it's not a joking matter, of course, but the inside story was, I should say, or the backstory, as we like to say, was that Horace Greeley knew very well that Lincoln had already drafted an Emancipation Proclamation, and was merely waiting for a Union battlefield victory to make it seem like he wasn't leading from a weak position. So Greeley wrote this vicious editorial, hoping later that he would get credit for pushing the president. And the president wrote a letter to the editor, to Horace Greeley, in which he said, "My paramount object is to save the Union. If I could do that by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. If I could do it by freeing some of the slaves, I would do it. If I could do it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would do that." What was the genius part of this? Well, first of all, it laid out exactly what his policy was. It made it seem he was not doing it for philanthropic or social reasons, which meant that more racist whites would tend to be supportive of it as a union-saving measure. And then third, to show who was boss in the journalism world, he gave it to another newspaper first. He sent it to the Washington Intelligencer, which published it on a Saturday, and his own inside joke was he knew Greeley didn't publish a Sabbath edition on Sunday, and they would have to wait two long, agonizing days before publishing a letter that was meant for him.
Today on The Exchange, we're talking about Lincoln and the power of the press. The 16th president is most often remembered for preserving the Union, abolishing slavery, and, of course, his untimely death. But a less documented aspect of the president's legacy, according to scholar Harold Hoser, was the extent of his involvement with the press and trying to shape public opinion through the newspapers. We hope you'll join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Harold Hoser, a moment ago you mentioned about how the letter to the editor that Lincoln wrote in response to Horace Greeley, he sent that to another newspaper, and then Greeley had to wait several days. But we were at a point in the newspaper industry where a day would matter, that the press had sped up to that point.
There was, as you said in the intro, a huge technological revolution afoot. And it was a revolution not only in the telegraph, which is the most often cited example, and it certainly did speed news around the country much more quickly than ever before. In the old days, they had to wait, you know, in St. Louis, they would wait for the New York newspapers to arrive, and in New York, they would wait for the London newspapers to arrive. So it was a slow, slow process. But one of the other major innovations was the steam printing press. And I think of that as important as the telegraph because it enabled sleepy, once-a-week newspapers to become daily papers, maybe, you know, twice, three times a day. Newspapers were capable of rushing to the streets with special editions if breaking news occurred. It's like we interrupt this program for a special report. So it's all the hallmarks of just bringing people closer to events all around the country. The difference between that and, let's say, today's 24-hour news culture.
We're just going to have to pick that up after a short break with Harold Hoser. We'll take your calls as well after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I am Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, we're talking with historian Harold Hoser about his new book, Lincoln and the Power of the Press. And you can join us by calling 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Just before the break, Harold Hoser, you were explaining the difference between what at that point sounded like the lightning speed of being able to publish once or maybe even more than once a day and the parallels to today's 24-hour news cycle.
Yeah, I was going to complain about something, and I'll do it very quickly, that you know, this intense news sharing of the mid-19th century really spurred voter participation. And if you look at the 1860 presidential election, 80% of eligible voters went to the polls. Admittedly, it was 80% of white males, but it was 80%. And today's New York Times detailed the, you know, tragic reduction in participation in off-year elections and presidential elections, for that matter, down to 60, which is, you know, in 2008 and 2012, which is considered high, and 30-something, the lowest. We've just gone through the lowest off-year election since 1942. So something is wrong. The 24-hour news cycle, which is supposed to be speeding information, the Internet, which is supposed to be speeding information, is making people strangely complacent about participating.
one of the interesting pieces that you note in this development, the rise of the mass press and the development of speed and quicker delivery, is that you also start to see, along with these very partisan newspapers, this effort to try and drive voters to the polls through their newspaper, the party mouthpiece,
right,
is the development of wire services like the Associated Press. This is the time when the AP starts up.
Yeah, and it starts up because, it starts up for what I think is a funny reason. So ships come in from Europe with laden with the London newspapers, particularly. And the tradition was that when the ships landed in New York City, there would be agents of the big newspapers, and they got 12 or 13 of them before they organized themselves into a press association. And, you know, the newspapers would be thrown on the dock, the ropes would be ripped open, and the guys would run back to their offices in Lower Manhattan and feed the news. They would be rewritten and published, hopefully, within a day or two. Well, then somebody had the idea of sending a little tugboat out to meet the boat a little early and racing back while the ship was being docked, so one paper would get a scoop and an edge. Well, then another paper started to do it. Then everybody was investing in boats, and the boats were crowding the harbor and making it difficult for the ocean liners or sail ships to dock. That's when the idea for a press association got underway. Let's stop exhausting ourselves trying to outmaneuver the ships and annoy the captains and fight for, you know, to get up, to scoot up the ropes first. So the Associated Press was formed, really to cut costs in terms of outracing each other to get European news.
Wow. We probably don't see much of that anymore.
Well, not with boats.
But not with boats,
the
anyway.
Same kind of thing, metaphorical boats.
Now, as a politician, Abraham Lincoln seemed to appreciate more than many in his day how that he could win support by winning the press to his side. And he would use a number of techniques to try and do that, including just access, personal visits to editors.
Well, in his formative years in Illinois, he was an astonishing visitor of newspaper offices. Whenever he'd make a speech or plead a law case, he would knock on the door of pro-Republican newspapers whose editors he had yet to meet. And there are wonderful accounts of, you know, people with their sleeves rolled up setting type, who doubled as the copy editors, getting word to come downstairs. There's this strange, tall-looking man who says it's Abraham Lincoln, who wants to say hello. And they would be irritated because they're on deadline. They'd say, well, I'm going to meet him. I won't roll my sleeves down, but I'll shake his hand. And Lincoln didn't care. He shook his hand. And then he would astonish them by saying things like, I know your town had voted 51% Democratic, 48% Whig last time, and a couple of percent for minor party candidates. And what can we do to get, you know, the precinct over north yonder to come closer to the fold? And they would be, you know, how the heck does this guy know all these election district, election district statistics? And he would go back 2-3 election cycles. He loved election statistics. And that's how he would charm them, by knowing their regions as well as they. And then from that moment on, you just see it all over Illinois. They just were absolutely enraptured, and he became their man. Of course, he didn't visit Democratic editors because there was no point. The press was openly partisan in those days. So he, you know, he did it at the Chicago Tribune. He knocked on the door. He said, I've got $4 to subscribe for your paper, as the editor remembered him saying. And then they went to hear him give a speech, and it was like thunderbolts dancing in the skies. So he won them over both on the stump and in the office. And he became a magical presence, and boy, he got them. As president, not so much access, but he had all the Republican editors on his side by the time he took office.
And that then paid off as he started to make his way into national politics. I'm thinking of one of the key early moments in his career is he's a member of Congress, his 1-2-year term, and he makes a very pointed speech in Congress about the war with the U.S. and Mexico in the 1840s. And how did that then play in the newspapers at the time?
Well, that precedes all of his personal efforts at personal suasion, I will say. But very much bad press on that, even from Whigs, who calculated that his going so far as to question the Mexican War while American troops were on foreign soil was an act of, at best, political foolish recklessness, and maybe at worst, lack of patriotism. And some people still believe, I happen to disagree, but some people still believe that it ended his congressional career after one term. You know, I found lots of stories when I wrote the book about his congressional years about Lincoln, you know, trying in vain to get important Washington editors to pay attention to him, to get his name in the papers, in the New York Tribune, the Washington papers, and it was a tough slog for him. And then at one point he erupts in this letter to his law partner back home, "You've just sent me a bunch of clippings from the local papers. My name isn't in them. What's going on?" You know, he's remote all the way out at Washington. They didn't go home, you know, on the weekends for district meetings, God knows. So he mastered it later. Certainly his congressional term was not a high example of mastery of the press. It was a period when he was extremely frustrated. And by the way, Horace Greeley, the editor of the New York Tribune, was serving in Congress at the time while editing the Tribune, having been appointed to fill an unexpired term. And here are two guys who opposed slavery, opposed the Mexican War, favored a high tariff. They should have born in a log cabin. I mean, they had a lot in common. They should have been made for each other, and they were like oil and water instead, to use two cliches in one sentence. And it was there was an unease about their relationship, despite their common goals, that lasted for the rest of their lives.
Greeley was one of the big New York paper, he's one of the big voices in New York newspapers, and New York, of course, being the newspaper capital of the country at that time. In the late 1850s, when Lincoln has become a national figure through the Lincoln-Douglas debates in the Illinois U.S. Senate race, he's starting to be mentioned as a potential national figure, potentially a presidential candidate. He's certainly interested in that. And in early 1860, he heads to New York to give a speech, which you've written about extensively, the Great Hall of Cooper Union. And that sort of secures his place in national politics. And this is a big moment for his relationship with the national press, people like Horace Greeley.
Yeah, and I wrote a bit about it in my 2005 book, Lincoln at Cooper Union. I expanded on it in the press book. I wanted to see every great event in Lincoln's life, if I could, purely through the eyes of journalists, you know, from Cooper Union to the Lincoln-Douglas debates to the Gettysburg Address to the inaugurals. And what he did at Cooper Union, aside from giving a fantastic address that absolutely enthralled New Yorkers who were dubious about this Westerner, who they heard was a, you know, good enough prairie debater, but certainly not sophisticated enough to be taken seriously in the big city, what he did is made sure that there was a pooled, corrected version of his speech ready to go at 2 a.m. in all of the city's big newspapers. The New York Tribune, Greeley, the New York Times, Henry Raymond, the New York Herald, James Gordon Bennett, and the New York Evening Post, William Cullen Bryant. Whether they were pro-Lincoln or anti-Lincoln, he wanted the speech on page one in all those papers. He personally proofread several versions of it to make sure there were no typos, to make sure there were no, you know, misalignments of paragraphs, and labored over it. And I think that was important. He had 1,500 ear witnesses, as one of my colleagues, fellow historians, likes to put it. But as far as reading witnesses, the next morning he had, you know, 150,000. And then it spread west from there. So he calculated that there were going to be two audiences from the beginning and made sure that he would be noticed, published, and ultimately he hoped, and it came true in the Republican papers, praised.
Today on The Exchange, we're talking about Lincoln and the power of the press. Abraham Lincoln is most often remembered for the Civil War, preserving the Union, abolishing slavery, and his assassination. But the less documented aspect of his legacy, according to scholar Harold Holzer, was the extent of his involvement with the press, which at the time was coming into its own as a strong partisan force in shaping public opinion. You can join us with your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us exchange@nhpr.org. After winning the presidency in the 1860 election, how much did Lincoln follow the usual, for lack of a better term, playbook for new administrations in setting up a footprint in newspapers and partisan press?
Well, the first thing he did to ensure loyalty was to reward Republican newspapers who had been supportive in two ways. One was government advertising and government printing contracts. Again, this is not an unusual occurrence. It's not illegal. It wasn't even considered unseemly. It was considered politics. And the second thing he did was, you know, as the first Republican president, he got the opportunity to completely remake the federal government and appoint thousands of people to jobs ranging from post offices to diplomatic posts. And boy, he did it. He took his time, but he did it ultimately. And among the people who were rewarded were newspapermen. They got postmasterships. They got consulates. Some got ambassadorships, or the equivalent of it. It wasn't called ambassador. The post wasn't called ambassador then. And their recommendations got more jobs. That was what they had been waiting for. And Lincoln, you know, you could say paid them off and ensured a great deal of loyalty into the future of his administration.
There was at least one example where it seems that the administration literally paid someone off, that there was cash exchange for a certain kind of press coverage.
Again, not unusual. If a newspaper was running out of money, the Republican National Committee had money. And by the way, in 1864, getting a little ahead of ourselves, but it's always worth, I always like to get this in. Imagine this today from Rachel Maddow or Bill O'Reilly on, let's say, the left and right of popular broadcast journalism. Henry Raymond, the founding publisher of the New York Times, its day-to-day editor, served during Lincoln's reelection campaign while editing the Times. As chairman of the Republican National Committee, a Republican candidate for Congress in Manhattan, and in his spare time, if he had any, he wrote a 700-page campaign biography of Lincoln, and that was the equivalent of running the media operation. So he was Arthur Sulzberger, David Axelrod, pick your congressional candidate, Gene Shaheen, take it to the next level of the Senate candidate, and chairman of the DNC at the same time. It's pretty extraordinary.
It's hard to think of in a way today, even as we talk about there was that Pew study that came out not so long ago talking about how different people will seek out news media sources depending on their partisan affiliations. And this seems to make today's partisanship look pretty tame.
Absolutely. And again, the problem is that we've lost our taste for that sort of we don't turn our faces away from partisan reports, but in a funny way, we complain about it all the time. We yearn for this kind of staid nonpartisanship. In Lincoln's day, when it was open and above board and sort of fun, as opposed to vote depressing, it got people to participate. And it's sad that it has the opposite effect today. And maybe the reason it has the opposite effect is that the big cable organizations, which are the closest thing I can see in the culture to those partisan newspapers, the big cable organizations do not, frankly, admit their affiliation and their preference. They coyly dance around it. And maybe if they became vote-generating machines, we would get more people to participate.
You mentioned about how Henry Raymond was not only the founding editor of the New York Times, but a very vocal Lincoln supporter in a number of different capacities. But in other ways, some of the other big voices in journalism of the time, and Horace Greeley is one that we've talked about a little bit so far, a New Hampshire native. Sometimes you keep your supporters even closer. You keep your supporters close and your enemies even closer. And Horace Greeley could be both sometimes at the same time for Lincoln.
Yeah, and he was a hard man to keep close. Again, they had this antipathy toward each other, or a sort of a cold, relationship. But Lincoln comes to Cooper Union, and Greeley praises him to the skies, not because he particularly likes Lincoln, but because he's going to be an alternative to the hated William Seward, who he just despises. who was supported by Henry Raymond of the Times, because Seward, he thinks, has denied him what he wants most. And Greeley is this enormously successful, influential editor. What does he want most? He wants to be a politician. He's been denied the governorship, the lieutenant governorship of New York, and he's frustrated and angry. So he goes to the Chicago nominating convention in 1860. But who does he support? He doesn't quite get it with Lincoln. And so he supports Edward Bates, the most conservative Republican, the oldest former slaveholder, really the most ridiculous possible choice. And, you know, then he sort of is late to the Lincoln bandwagon. He wants, we think, to be postmaster general. He doesn't get the call. He then runs for senator from New York. He's defeated. And again, he's frustrated for the rest of the Lincoln administration. And they do not have an easy relationship at all.
And Lincoln then has to spend some of his time trying to bring Greeley back into the fold whenever he can?
Absolutely. I mean, there were ways he did it, and he used different techniques on different people. Greeley wanted power. Lincoln gave him, the most Lincoln would give him is his patronage choices in New York and other cities. The people he supported got jobs. But, you know, Greeley was against having a civil war. Then he was for the civil war. Then in 1864, he was against Lincoln running for second term. And then he tried to create his own peace effort, actually have a peace conference with Confederate delegates to undermine Lincoln. And then he came back to the fold. But, you know, tough relationship. Lincoln tried to go to his lectures and pay obeisance to him. It never was quite what either man wanted. Raymond was a company man through and through. He was a party man, not saying a party hack, but whenever he went off the reservation a little bit, because these were all independent and intelligent people, Lincoln would call him down to Washington and put, you know, his big hand on his shoulder. Raymond was a little guy and probably felt that arm slap pretty hard, and he came right back into the fold.
Meanwhile, Greeley was too powerful to ignore and too unpredictable to count on. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Harold Holzer about Lincoln and the power of the press. We'll also take your calls and emails. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Back after a short break. This is The Exchange. This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, New Hampshire's preparations for the possibility of an Ebola case in the state. Today, we're talking about Abraham Lincoln and the power of the press with historian Harold Holzer. And you can join us by calling in at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org, or find us on Twitter or Facebook. Harold Holzer, what we haven't talked about yet in terms of Lincoln and the power of the press is that most of his presidency took place in the context of the Civil War. And that brings up some big questions about the role of the press during wartime, as has happened in every war.
And never as dramatically and with so much controversy as it did during the Civil War, because Lincoln and his administration and his military apparatus had to decide how to draw the line, and it was a very movable line, between dissent and treason. And they struggled with that, and newspapers struggled with that throughout the war. And I calculate that over 200 or so newspapers were shut down, Democratic newspapers all shut down during the war by the Post Office Department, the Commerce Department, the Post Office Department, the State Department, the Army, and on one famous occasion in New York by Lincoln himself for various transgressions that were considered, at least by the administration, as giving aid and comfort to the enemy.
There was an uproar after that, a signed letter by a number of prominent protesters, and Lincoln wrote a letter essentially in response to that defending his decision. It's known today as the Corning Letter. Could you tell us about that?
Well, that was one shutdown that he was not too enamored of. It happened in Chicago. The Chicago Times was a Democratic sheet that was increasingly anti-war, anti-Lincoln. And General Ambrose Burnside, who was unsuccessful at winning the Battle of Fredericksburg, found it much easier to occupy the Chicago Times than he did the city of Fredericksburg, Virginia. So he closed it down for dissenting for arguing that the union had been mistaken in arresting an Ohio former congressman for arguing against the draft and conscription. Well, so the Times is shut down. Chicagoans are upset. Lincoln countermands the order. But in Albany, a Democratic group issues a very strong protest letter condemning Lincoln for simply sacrificing the Constitution in the name of saving the Union. And Lincoln writes a famous letter again, knowing, and by the way, releases it to the press, not just to the gentleman to whom he wrote it, Erastus Corning, in which he said, yes, I am in some cases sacrificing constitutional liberties to save the whole country and the possibility that democracy will survive. And he wrote it all in this brilliant, homey way that he had of reaching, he thought, the common man with the most effectiveness, saying, you know, think about, you accuse me of sacrificing the Constitution. Well, in our battlefields, you would never kill a body to save a leg, but you would sacrifice a leg to save the body. And that's what I'm doing. But even more specifically, to use a medical analogy, no one takes emetics and likes them so well that he uses them as his diet for the rest of his life. When this war is over, when the normal relations of government are restored, then there won't be any censorship. There won't be any abrogation of the free press. That was his promise. He didn't quite live to be put to the test, but it was a controversy up until the end of his administration.
And at this time, the Civil War was giving, because of the developments in the speed at which newspapers could publish, reporters could get as close to real time as the press had ever done up to that point. So you have reporters who are on the battlefield reporting on generals and movements even sometimes. And so it's not always just a case of whether a newspaper is printing something that the administration likes or dislikes, but actually the tried and true questions about whether something does compromise national security during
wartime. Absolutely. I mean, General Lee said that he figured out where to move his army when he invaded Pennsylvania in 1863 by reading the Philadelphia Inquirer, because that's how he figured out where the Union army was. It may be a little bit of a romanticization, but there was that concern, and it continued through the Civil War. Correspondents were embedded, you know, hundreds and hundreds of correspondents, but they were also subject to censorship. Generals like William Sherman and George Gordon Meade hated the press, punished the press. Sherman even had a journalist court-martial for traveling with his army without permission. Lincoln had to countermand that, too. And journalists found it very hard to get things past the telegraphic censors in Washington. The telegraph office was placed in the library of the ferocious Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, and he appointed someone whom he called the military censor. So it could be which operation could be totally ridiculous. Henry Raymond himself got back from the Battle of Bull Run and was embarrassed that his early report said the Union had won, so he tried to file a report saying the Confederacy routed the Union late in the afternoon and turned the tide, and the censors said, well, this doesn't seem like a very nice thing to write, so I'm not sending it. Raymond learned a lesson that day and found other means to get his news.
I was going to say, because you sometimes hear about cases where an administration might try to encourage the press to share, I think of the Vietnam era press, where the government was sending out reports trying to say the war is going well, and it sounds like that there was some of that going on during the Civil War as well.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I mean a major difference is, this is a little bit of field, but the concurrent rise of photography as a source of information, and the very grisly and very honest battlefield death scenes that were exhibited in New York. The work of Alexander Gardner and Matthew Brady, compare that to what Americans don't see about the wars in the Middle East. We don't even allow coffins to be shown anymore, as we did routinely in Vietnam, to the degree that it inflated, not inflated, but it triggered a lot of opposition, just that relentless sight of coffins being rolling off cargo planes in Washington.
There's a story in your book about a paper here in Concord, New Hampshire, the Democratic Standard, which has taken an anti-war stance, and there's a regiment returning from Bull Run that comes back into town, and they burn the paper down. How common was it that a paper might face trouble outside of government, but from essentially just the public, vigilantes perhaps?
Well, there were two periods in 1861 when this sort of mob violence was occurring and sort of tolerated. One was after the firing on Fort Sumter, on the American flag. Papers that didn't support the Lincoln's call the next day for volunteers were subject to not only indictment in the courts, as happened in New York, but mob attack, you know, tarring and feathering of editors in Massachusetts, the closing of papers in New England, Rhode Island, and Maine. But then in July, the first 100-day volunteers are dismissed from the service, and they go back home. And most of them are veterans of the campaign at Bull Run, which had, again, been a Union victory that turned into a Union disaster. It was the battle that was supposed to end the war, and instead it was the first of countless tragic, you know, catastrophe battles and casualty-filled battles. So these soldiers came home, some of them still wearing their uniforms, to read the Democratic paper, said the Battle Bull Run should be a lesson, that this is a folly of a war and no more men should be sacrificed, and also were reporting that the officers did badly and the men ran. And the soldiers, the ex-soldiers, felt that their honor was being challenged, and they got liquored up, and they took matters into their own hands. And there was a sad tradition in America that abolitionist papers, principally, were subject to a higher law than the law of the, you know, the courts. And printing presses were destroyed. Editors were attacked by mobs as well. So it was a pretty ugly spring and summer in terms of press freedom. I give Lincoln credit because press freedom might have been abandoned in America completely and permanently. Lincoln always brought back an open press for any political campaign that was going on nationally. So for the off-year election of 1862 and for his own campaign in 1864, he absolutely had no objection to criticism and, you know, the most merciless lampooning and assaults and outrageous lies from newspapers that had been closed previously, like the Chicago Times, like the New York World. He thought that political campaigns were sacred enough to be exemptions to the rule.
Now, by and large, the big papers of that day were written by and read by whites, but there was an African-American press, which was quite voluminous at that time, too. And what did they make of Lincoln's presidency at the time?
Well, there were moments when they were pleased, obviously. You know, by a year and a half into the war, Lincoln did issue his Emancipation Proclamation, or announced his Emancipation Proclamation, and that was clearly a moment for editorial rejoicing. Until that time, they were pretty critical, including Frederick Douglass, who ran the most famous African-American newspaper of all, Douglass's Monthly. When Lincoln gave his first inaugural address, which was his, you know, last attempt at keeping secession from spreading and to maybe starting negotiations to restore the Union without war. One of the things he said is, you know, I don't want to interfere with slavery where it exists. I'm pledged to that. And to show you that I will adhere to the laws, I will even enforce the hated Fugitive Slave Act. Well, Douglass went crazy. He said that he's using the language of slave catchers and overseers, and it's not acceptable from a Republican that we poured our heart and soul in support of. And then again in 1863, when the first African Americans were recruited for the armed services, Lincoln asked Frederick Douglass to give up his paper and campaign to get African Americans to volunteer, but then approved a pay structure that would compensate African American volunteers at a lower rate than whites. Lincoln thought it was just too much to expect that white troops, whose continued loyalty he desperately needed to fill the ranks, would accept equal pay for African-American troops. He believed it had to happen gradually. And again, Frederick Douglass and other black newspapers were very vocal in their criticism because it was pretty outrageous. Typical of Lincoln, you know, he was slow but sure in his march toward freedom and equality. So he had a tough time with the African-American press. It was a very interesting press. Was it a powerful press? You know, no disrespect intended, but it wasn't. You know, it rallied, it prepared African-Americans for citizenship, but it did not speak to a lot of voters because African-Americans, by and large, were denied the right to vote in many states, most states. And Lincoln was all about using the newspapers to win elections. That's what he saw the press role as. And so the black press could be angered, as far as he was concerned, because it wouldn't mean much in terms of elections.
Lincoln's last election was 1864 when he ran for a second term as president. Did the press play a big role in at least in trying to turn out those Republican voters in the Union as he had done in past elections?
Absolutely. And you know, at first, as I said, the Tribune sort of did an anyone but Lincoln campaign. Let's have John Fremont. Let's have Ulysses S. Grant, any candidate but Lincoln. Even after Lincoln won the nomination, even after Sherman took Atlanta, Horace Greeley of the Tribune sent a letter to all the Republican governors in the country saying maybe we should hold another convention and dump Lincoln and choose another candidate. He was completely tone deaf about what Sherman's victory at Atlanta meant in terms of game-changing the campaign. But after that, with Henry Raymond in the lead as the head of the RNC, Republican newspapers were extremely supportive. They urged people to vote. Lincoln even got the long Democratic New York Herald to tone down its editorials and criticize his opponent as harshly as it did Lincoln. And they had been critical of Lincoln for four long years. And some people say there was a deal struck between intermediaries representing Abraham Lincoln and the fiery sort of tabloid-type editor of the Herald, James Gordon Bennett. No paperwork exists. No smoking gun has survived. But right after the election, Lincoln nominated James Gordon Bennett to be ambassador to France. And Bennett then turned it down. So maybe the deal was, you don't have to endorse me because nobody would take it seriously, but tone down the criticism. I'll offer you a really prestigious appointment, and then you'll turn it down because all you want is the acknowledgement. And that's how it transpired. Lincoln didn't live long enough to ever explain it. But one of the most interesting episodes of pay for play in Lincoln's history with the press.
And as you mentioned, shortly after that election, Lincoln was inaugurated and then assassinated. 4 years of sometimes very heavy criticism from opponents. And then after April 15th, 1865, the press starts to speak for at least a moment with one voice in support of the martyred president.
Yeah, it was a very brief piece. Not only one voice, but I compare headlines in New York. There was a moment when they were echoing each other, ping-ponging phrases like our nation's loss back and forth on the front pages of the Herald, the Times, and the Tribune. These are papers, you know, two Republican, one Democratic, but all three editors had been involved with each other financially at one point, had broken away from each other, and absolutely hated each other. I mean, we talk about political attacks. The papers were filled with vituperative attacks between editors against each other. Those were always their principal foes, really anger. And for them to take a breath, even for a week, and pause in unity to reflect on Lincoln's passing was an extraordinary moment. It wasn't a permanent moment. Things got back to normal very soon, and that's probably why there was so much excitement about the issues to come: Reconstruction, the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, the ascent of Ulysses S. Grant. It just continued status quo with the same partisan press frenzy that had really risen to an apex in the Lincoln era.
And as for Lincoln himself, as Edwin Stanton, his Secretary of War, put it now, he belongs to the ages. Harold Holzer, it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I've enjoyed it so much. Thank you.
Harold Holzer is a historian on Lincoln and the political culture of the Civil War. He is also chair of the U.S. Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation and winner of the National Humanities Medal. His latest book, Lincoln and the Power of the Press. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Joanna Albertson-Grove. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.